1-800-273-8153 or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader for more information. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's the college admissions season, so this spring we're joining our colleagues at Morning Edition to talk about the challenge of paying for higher education. And we're not just talking about the problem, though. We're trying to offer practical advice to get around that money maze. Today we want to focus on historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs. For generations, these institutions have opened the door to higher education for millions of African-American students. In recent years, they have also provided an affordable and accessible education for students of other backgrounds. These days, though, many HBCUs are facing enormous financial challenges along with the students they serve. We wanted to hear more about that, so we've called upon Mary Beth Gassman. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education, where she studies historically black schools. Professor Gassman, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us for additional perspective, David Wilson, president of Morgan State University. That's an historically black public university in Baltimore. President Wilson, thank you so much for joining us once again.
It's a pleasure being here as well.
Professor Gassman, I'm going to start with you because we hear a lot about how the cost of college has skyrocketed in recent years. Is the same thing true for the HBCUs? Are they still affordable?
HBCUs are very affordable. In fact, their tuition is about 50% of majority institutions. So it costs 50% less to attend an HBCU. They're incredibly affordable. Even the private colleges are half as much as majority private institutions in terms of their tuition. So HBCUs, in fact, are a bargain compared to other institutions.
President Wilson, despite that, though, we still understand that a lot of the students who come to these schools have financial challenges of their own. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And I totally agree with Professor Gassman that HBCUs are still a great bargain today. And in terms of the tuition here at Morgan, for example, a full year is less than $5,000 a year. But what we see at Morgan is quite similar to what we see across the HBCU spectrum. About 90% of our students are on financial aid. And so even though we have absolutely tried to keep tuition at a very, very affordable level, we still see that our students struggle a bit in coming up with, in this case, you know, $5,000 a year in tuition. Now, that's not the total cost of attendance, but our students are still struggling.
You know, you used to hear it commonly said of people who worked their way through school. I was not able to do that. I mean, even if I worked, you know, constantly, by the time I came along, I couldn't manage it in the kinds of salaries that I could command as a student. Is my impression correct that that's a relatively rare experience these days, and why is that?
Well, I can respond to that. I mean, there are an enormous number of students who are working students, and in fact, are working sometimes two jobs. The research does show that if you're working between 10 and 12 hours a week, that it can really benefit you because it makes you more organized and it helps you to find balance. It's when you go over, really, when you go over, you know, 17, 20, some students are working 35 hours a week. That's where, you know, this is becoming dangerous. But I do think that it is a little bit harder. I also think that some of those stories of working your way through college can be a little bit exaggerated from the past. I think people are actually working a little bit more now than they used to be.
Hmm. President Wilson, what about you? Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do. I do think there's some truth to that. Of course, you know, I ended up working my way through undergraduate school, so to speak. I mean, I had two or three on-campus jobs, and it was really, really tough to work 15, 20 hours a week even back then and graduate on time. And so we are seeing here at Morgan as well, a lot of our students are working enormous hours, if you will. And what is happening is that the more hours they work, the fewer credit hours they take. And so the graduation rates are affected by that. And so I think anytime you're serving a population where the students are coming from families that simply cannot afford to contribute handsomely to their education and they have to work on the side, you're going to see some of the things that we're seeing at our institution and across the HBCU world.
What are some of the things you're seeing?
It is taking students a bit longer to get their degrees. The research is showing that working, especially in kind of menial jobs, is not really very good for students who are majoring in engineering and the sciences. And they need to be spending more and more of that time in the classroom and on research projects. And so we certainly see here at Morgan that having those students work in, you know, those fast food places and others places getting in the way of their ability to move smoothly through the curriculum and to graduate in 4 or 5 years.
Interesting. Professor Gassman, you've reported on the fact, we've reported on the fact that a number of HBCUs are struggling with low graduation rates. Does cost factor into that? I mean, do you still find students dropping out because they can't make enough money or find enough money to come back to finish their educations? What do you think is going on there?
It's absolutely a problem. And one of the issues that HBCUs have, they have less institutional aid because they have lower endowments and they have fewer private gifts that are given to them. And so that's less money to give to students during times of crises. So that can make it difficult on students in terms of staying in college. So I would say that definitely is a problem. But this is not necessarily an HBCU problem. Across the board, what we find is that students from low-income families have a much more difficult time graduating. And if you just think about it, think about what happens in families that don't have a savings account. When the bottom falls out, it falls out completely. So if you're a low-income student, when things start to get a little bit stressful in school, you don't really have anything to fall back on.
To that end, noting your research, the average endowment for private colleges is $223 million. The average endowment for a private HBCU is $38 million. And I guess that affects the ability to offer discretionary aid. Like, for example, if a student has a changing family circumstance right in the middle of his or her student career. For example.
Absolutely. Or you know, let's say their books are overwhelmingly expensive one semester. And a change in a family situation is a really good example, because one thing we also know is that if you're from a low-income family, you're more likely to have like some crises in your family because people sometimes are living on the edge. I mean, I was from one of these families and there were lots of crises in my family, and it changed my college situation. If an institution doesn't have that kind of buffering system through a larger endowment, it can be difficult for students.
If you're just joining us, it's our Paying for College series. We're talking about the financial challenges for students at historically black colleges and universities, and also the opportunity of the historically black colleges and universities, which offer, in many cases, a more affordable option for students. My guests are Mary Beth Gassman of the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education and David Wilson, president of Morgan State University, which is in Baltimore. So let's wheel around and talk a little bit about some practical advice. I mean, one of the things we've talked about previously is that, you know, sometimes people can negotiate more than they think they can on financial aid. President Wilson, on the one hand, I'm sure you've got a lot of people there who are very sympathetic to students' circumstances and are not shocked by them when they find out a student comes in and says, you know, my brother died and my parents had to pay for the funeral and that's why I don't have the money for the semester. On the other hand, there's often less of a cushion to work with. Do you have some advice for students and families who find themselves in a bind, perhaps an unexpected bind? What should they do?
Well, I certainly think that many of the institutions do whatever they can to set aside institutional aid. This is not federal aid, but primarily dollars that they collect through tuition, and reallocate those dollars to students who are in need of the financial assistance that they need to keep going. And so I would say to those students, of course, you know, your first option would certainly be to go to university financial aid office to see if there are institutional funds that may be available to keep you going. Here at Morgan, we take about $12 million of the amount of money that we collect in tuition fees, and we reallocate that money to students who are in dire need of financial assistance to keep going, and those students are making good academic progress.
Professor Gassman, you have some thoughts about this?
One thing that I tell all students, no matter where they are, is you should ask for anything that you need. When I was a little girl, my mom told me, you know, all they can say is no. So I always ask for what I need, and I think that's really important. I think that you should make sure to establish relationships with faculty and staff. The better relationships you have, the more likely you are to be in the public eye, and your needs are to be in the public eye. I always tell students that. I also would say that that I think people should look at the wide scope of colleges and universities that we have in the country and really take a look at what they offer students and what kind of safety nets that they have in place. I would ask questions about the safety nets. I would also ask questions about student support programs that support you during difficult times, because you want to make sure that those programs are out there. So asking, if it's not the student, have the parents ask those kinds of questions. Those are important.
I wanted to ask, though, about both of you mentioned the experience of working paying jobs to help you get through college. Mm-hmm. And that was also an experience of mine, so I'll just say. You also talked, though, sometimes about the difficulty of balancing work and study. So can you talk a little bit from your own experience, as briefly as you can, about how you would advise a student to balance that?
Well, you know, from my perspective, what I wish I had in front of me at the time but did not was an internship experience. I can recall, you know, as an undergraduate at Tuskegee that, you know, I pretty much had to, you know, paint all of the solid lines on the roads throughout the campus. And, you know, while that enabled me to make a few bucks, it didn't do anything in terms of advancing my intellectual capacity. What I would say is look for those opportunities that are compatible, you know, with what you are studying at the university. Then those 15, 20 hours or so per week, they are almost like an extension, you know, of your laboratory experience or an extension of the discipline in which you're studying. And I think that would certainly be compatible with the kind of educational goals and missions that we have at our institutions.
David Wilson is president of Morgan State University. He was kind enough to join us from member station WEAA in Baltimore. Mary Beth Gassman is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. She joined us from that campus. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Our pleasure. Thank you, Michelle.
You can also weigh in with your own story or question about the higher education money maze on Twitter at hashtag paying for college. Coming up, as Kenya's parliament moved to revise its century-old marriage laws, a fierce debate erupted over polygamy.
As much as you take care of the Islamic marriages and the Christian marriages, let us also take care of the customary marriages.
We'll hear more about the issue and what caused the women lawmakers to walk out. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, Karen Russell, author of the bestseller Swamplandia, talks about her new novella, Sleep Donation. It's set in the near future during an insomnia epidemic. Russell imagines an America where new insomniacs are forced to file for dream bankruptcy and wait to be approved for sleep donors. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's a cliche, but it's true. Our next guest needs no introduction. Walter Mosley is the author of more than 40 acclaimed books that have captured the evolving Black experience and beyond. He has created complicated and memorable characters like Ezekiel Easy Rollins, played by Denzel Washington in the 1995 film version of Devil in a Blue Dress.
I first came out to Los Angeles when I got home from the war in Europe with $300 in my pocket and the G.I. Bill. Like me, a lot of colored folk from Texas and Louisiana had moved out to California to get them good jobs in the shipyards and in the aircraft companies. Now, me, myself, I was a machinist. And the first thing I did when I saved enough money was to buy me a house. Man, I I love coming home to my house. I don't know. I guess maybe I just loved owning something.
In addition to his many novels, Mosley has also put his hand to nonfiction on matters of public interest. And if that were not enough, he has a new play premiering next month. Not surprisingly, Walter Mosley is being honored at the 12th National Black Writers Conference being held in New York City this weekend, which is really just an excuse to talk to him again. So congratulations on that and welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you very much. Great to be here.
You know, I was looking up my notes and I realized I talked to you almost 4 years ago to the day. And back then, this is true, and back then I said you had more than 24 books to your credit. Now it's nearly 48, and I don't think I'm the only one who wants to know how you managed to keep up this pace.
Oh, it's easy to write. I think you probably wrote more than 24 books 4 years ago. But the truth is, I don't update it every time I write a book, but I just write every morning for 2 to 3 hours, about 360 days a year or more. And that seems to make the books come. So
do you get antsy if you don't write something? Do you feel like uncomfortable?
I'm very unhappy if 2 days go by and I haven't written.
The award that you're getting this weekend, or you're being honored at this conference, it's just chock full of exciting names and people who are doing exciting things. Did you ever imagine that there would be enough people like you around to have a conference like this?
Well, you know, when I first went to this conference, it was 1988. It was 2 years before my first book was published. And there were like 300 black writers at that conference, many of them good, and none of them being published that year, except one, Terry McMillan, was getting published that year. But to be at the conference with, you know, working writers who are getting published, that was not believable at that time.
Why do you still go to things like this? I mean, you're the, for many people, you are the reason to go. I was wondering why you go.
Well, I think that it's, you know, one of the more important conferences for black writers in America. And I think that that's really important for us to remember that we are that. I remember when I was there in 1988, I was listening to Terry talk. She hadn't, you know, really broken through yet. And she was saying, well, if you want to get published, you have to have the letterhead from the publisher and you have to go from church to church and have books in your trunk of your car. I didn't even have a car. And so I was thinking, God, I'll never get published. So it's good when you can talk to people about, well, you know, We can do this. This is possible.
Well, speaking of books you're not going to take door-to-door to churches to get published, let's talk about the next one. Debbie Doesn't Do It Anymore is scheduled for May. The novel's main character is in the adult entertainment business. She's a star. And her husband's accidentally electrocuted himself performing a sex act, right? And alluding to the title, as I understand it, she wants to get out of the business, right?
In the first 8 pages of the book, she quits the business.
Yeah, so she quits the business.
And the rest of the book is, you know, what happens.
I think that a lot of people are excited about this, but so many of your famous protagonists are men, and I think this is the first time you've put a female protagonist at kind of at the center of the story, correct?
Does that? It's a female protagonist. Yeah. It's first person narrative. Yeah. So I'm writing from her point of view. She's seeing the world. This woman who's very recognizable, you know, 6 feet tall, you know, almost jet black skin. She has platinum blonde hair, you know, down her back and blue contact lenses. You know, she's a very recognizable figure in the porn industry and is now leaving.
I think many people, you know, associate you as portraying the black experience through the perspective of your characters over time in different eras faced with different situations. I was thinking about the essay that you wrote around the Trayvon Martin case, and you were reflecting on the way that George Zimmerman, the shooter, was described. And you said, you know, he's identified variously as white, half Hispanic or Hispanic. And you said all of these terms have their roots drenched in the lifeblood of racism. Yeah. And so race is kind of one of the many things that we get wrong, right, I would say?
Well, of course. I mean, the truth is I've been giving this talk a lot lately that the big issue about race in America is that there really is no such thing as white people. And, you know, in order to end race in America, all we have to do is recognize that the notion a white person doesn't really exist on any term and in any way.
How would you like us to think about this?
You know, that people think about who they are from culture, not from supposed DNA or color or what continent, you know, somebody came from a long time ago. Because then you could start talking about European people, you know. My mother's Jewish, of course, which makes me Jewish. And people say, well, how does it feel to be half white and half black? And I said, my mother's Jewish. That's not white. And then slowly, I mean, over time, I said, but nobody's white. Gypsies aren't white, and Vikings aren't white, and the Greeks aren't white, and the Spaniards aren't white. You know, they are who they are, you know, and they understand themselves in a certain kind of way. That got redefined in America because they had to kill the Native Americans and enslave the Africans. And so they had to become white people.
We've got so much going on. You've got a play coming out. And do you have any more books that have already been written that you just haven't published yet?
I just finished the Nouise Rawlins novel, and I'm about to start writing the Leonid McGill. And I'm writing a political monograph called Moving the Red into the Black. I think it's very obvious. The 20th century is the dialectical battle between so-called socialism and capitalism. But now that we're in the 21st century, you know, we have to realize what part of our lives need to be social, where we have to get along, we have to work supporting each other, and what part of our lives have to be our own work realized for ourselves, which is kind of the base of capitalism.
Walter Mosley is an award-winning novelist and playwright. He's being honored at the National Black Writers Conference this weekend in New York City. Walter Mosley, thank you.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Let's head to Kenya now, where there is a new focus on marriage laws. As you probably know, a number of African countries have been in the news of late because of their efforts to discourage same-sex relationships through law. Our focus today is on a law that speaks to what's called traditional marriage, and that includes polygamy. Last week, the Kenyan parliament passed a bill that legalizes polygamy and allows some men to take multiple wives without having to consult their current spouse. Here is one member of parliament arguing for this provision.
When you marry an African woman, she must know the second one is on the way. The third one is on the way. The fourth one is on the way, Mr. Speaker.
Comments like that sparked a walkout by a majority of women members, including the Honorable Anna Nyokabi Gathecha, who had this to say on the floor.
If you choose to marry, it's not that there's an objection to that, but I think it's important that you, as the man of the house, inform the rest of your wives that you will agree that you are bringing in another person.
Now, the bill is now awaiting the president's signature, and while some activists are still upset, others say this move to bring traditional marriages into a legal framework alongside those of other religions actually offers some needed protections for women and girls. And that's the view taken by the Honorable Anna Nyokabi Gathecha, the person who was speaking earlier, and she is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Can I ask you what brought this bill forward to begin with? I understand that marriage laws hadn't been updated in Kenya for a century. Is that right?
That's right. We've had the marriage bill that was operational before this one that we've passed from 1901, the colonial marriage laws. All we've had is just the amendments that, but we haven't had a complete inclusive marriage bill. And it has been a while. It has had several female cabinet ministers in tears as they tried to bring forth a marriage bill that protected every single person within the marriage institution. But it was not to be simply because you were not able to. Whenever you go with marriage, there's also the marriage divorce and the property associated. So it had been very difficult to change. Anytime you bring in the issue of property and succession rights within Kenya, it just, I think anywhere within an African context, it's a very difficult and emotive subject. So we were able to separate the two, the Marriage Property Act and the marriage bill that dealt with just the definition of what a marriage is, who can be able to perform a marriage ceremony, the contracting parties, the age, their definition, and then, of course, to definitely bring in and to recognize all other marriages, whether it's Christian, Hindu, Muslim, the traditional civil marriages, all of them are now looked at under this particular bill.
And what were some of the problems that you were trying to address with this? I mean, as I understand it, there were situations where a person died and that there were marriage partners that were unknown to others and until the death. Is that right?
What happens if the husband is living in different cities, he may have contracted a traditional marriage upcountry in his home area. Where he's working in the city, he'll contract another marriage. There may be other side marriages on the side that may not be known. The requirement that every single marriage in Kenya be registered is one of the greatest wins that we have had, because we find that upon the death of the husband, all of a sudden we have him and all his other partners coming up with their various families that they've had, and nobody knew about them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, even when they do the traditional marriage ceremonies, depending on the interests of the siblings of the man who has passed on, it becomes difficult for them to recognize or to agree to recognize, because they'd rather divide the property among themselves and leave out this particular, the wife that has been left there. So you find that there, in many cases where the husband has passed on, they try to throw the woman out of the home. Homestead, they don't want to recognize the children, and all kinds of suffering takes place as they try to eject them out of the home. What we wanted to accomplish with this particular marriage bill is to recognize every single marriage and to have it registered, so there would be no disputing. Whether you do it under traditional law or whatever it is, it needs to be registered so that those families are granted the protection under the marriage bill.
Now, internationally, as you might imagine, a lot of people are focusing on the plural marriage aspect of it. But you were also telling us that that only applies to people in traditional and Muslim marriages, right? For example, if you were to marry in a Christian church under Christian norms, you would not be permitted multiple marriages. Is that correct?
That is correct. When you mention polygamy, it seems like it's a man's dream to be able to have as many wives as possible. But once you start a marriage or the union that you enter into, if it's a monogamous union, you cannot change halfway. And that's why most of the churches were in an uproar, but there is really a lack of understanding and people who haven't read the marriage bill to see what it is that we were trying to do. One, if you're in a civil marriage, you go marry another woman, that's bigamy. Within a Christian marriage, you cannot marry more than one wife. It says so according to the various religions. And therefore, you cannot change halfway and say that you've become traditional. That was not the agreement at the outset of the marriage. And that's why it's important for those deciding or choosing to enter into contract into the various marriages, they understand what it is that they're getting into. Mm. So if you start your union monogamous, it goes monogamous right until the end.
I know that the age limit was also very important to you and a number of other members. For example, the law now stipulates that the age of consent for marriage has now been set at 18. How is this going to be enforced?
Every chief, district commissioner, sub-administrator, these are all people who are out in the village areas. We're hoping that they will be able to report all of this, because of the requirement for you to register. You cannot register marriage to somebody who is under the age of 18. There's a requirement for you to state your full names, the contracting spouse, the parents, and to bring the birth registration for each of the partners. So this, we're hoping, will go a long way in protecting the young girls within the society from early child marriages.
How do you feel about the whole thing now? As we mentioned earlier, you were one among the members who walked out at a certain point in the debate. I was curious about what exactly made you walk out. I mean, was it spontaneous? Was it just that you felt it was you were being disrespected? And how do you feel about the whole package now?
We felt we were being disrespected. It became ridiculous that to a point where nobody was listening to any reason, and all they wanted to do was just, once they get the microphone, to make as outrageous a statement as they can in order to, I guess, rally the male members of parliament that were available to support them in this particular cause. Because when you think about it rationally, depending on which particular tradition, a man did not go out to look for the second wife. It is the first wife who looked for the second wife. So for them to come out and try to be so bravado and thump their chests, it's actually not productive. Just to me and to most of the women parliamentarians who were there, mm-hmm. felt that it was just completely wrong the way that they chose to engage the whole debate.
How do you feel about the total package? Do you want the president to sign it?
When we take a look at those who have been contracted now in the polygamous marriage, and especially out in the rural areas where they don't have access to the right kind of education or proper education within this, they don't have access to most of the facilities that people within urban areas have, I think it's an important gain. Will the president sign? I don't know. But, you know, we can always amend, and we are looking to get together after 6 months to put in the amendments to ensure that the aspect of at least informing does take place.
We've mentioned that there has been a move across a number of countries in both East and West Africa to address the question of same-sex relationships through law. In a number of countries, the penalties for engaging in same-sex relationships have been substantially enhanced. Now, this law states very clearly that marriage is a voluntary union of a man or a woman, or in some cases, multiple women. So is the issue of same-sex relationships addressed at all, or will it be?
It is. Currently, same-sex relationships are illegal. There was certain clauses that were amended to ensure that same-sex union issues will not be brought in through the back door or through any amendment that would come in. And that was why they chose to define a marriage as between a man and a woman or women. As to whether the mood in the country is to introduce that particular law, given that it's already banned within the current constitution, then it just, I guess it remains as is.
The Honorable Anna Nyokabi-Gathecha is a member of parliament for Kiambu County. She joined us via the BBC studios in Nairobi, Kenya. A member of parliament, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're wrapping up our month-long series on women in tech. We'll catch up with a few of the industry pros that have joined the conversation on Twitter and get a few final words of wisdom. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
Hi, I'm Donda Beard, WILL's Development Director.
And I'm John Steinbacher, Membership Director. It's almost time for our annual April Pledge Drive. Starting on April 5th, we'll be seeking to raise $140,000 in just 8 days.
It's a big goal, but the moment we reach $140,000, we'll end the drive.
Wait. Didn't we do that last year?
Yes, we did. And we were able to end our drive one day early.
Right. Yeah, let's do that again. And maybe we could also have a day where we let people donate on behalf of their pets. Come on, it'll be fun. I've heard that Steve Inskeep is very popular in the goat community.
Well, my dog Wally does love listening to Classic Mornings with Vic.
There you go. That's the spirit.
Okay, let's do it. But let's not lose sight of the real goal, which is to ensure that we can continue to provide great news, ag coverage, and classical music to our listeners.
This Week in This American Life, when Chris was a toddler, he'd bite his mom, he was conniving, and he had a birthmark in the middle of his forehead that everybody called his devil mark, which wasn't prominent.
Unless I was angry, at which point it turned bright red. And my mother has actually said that it glowed.
I'm not saying that he was evil. Okay, maybe I am saying that. Bad Babies, This Week.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. March is coming to a close, and sadly, that means we're wrapping up our Women in Tech series for Women's History Month. Throughout the month, influential and innovative women from all over the world have been tweeting a day in their lives using the hashtag NPRWIT. We also spoke on air with trailblazers about new ideas they're bringing to tech and how they're encouraging more young women to get into and stay in the so-called STEM fields, and that means science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, we're going to look at some of the lessons learned and how women can move ahead in tech. So joining us for our final roundtable for now are Sabrina Hersey-Issa. She is the CEO of Be Bold Media. That group uses technology and media to help mission-driven organizations connect with or build their networks. She's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome, Sabrina. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us, Nora May Cadena. She is an aerospace engineer at Boeing and co-founder of Latinas in STEM. She's with us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Nora May, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Ingrid Vandervelt is entrepreneur in residence at Dell, where she is an advisor to the executive team, including the CEO. She also heads the Dell Center for Entrepreneurs, which, as you might imagine, exists to help entrepreneurs run and grow their businesses. And she's also the founder of Billionaire Girls Club. She's with us from Austin, Texas. Ingrid, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you all. I should start by saying thank you all for your contributions to the series. It was wonderful, so thank you all so much. And I just wanted to start, Sabrina, I'll ask you to start us off by asking you how you got into tech.
So it's kind of a roundabout story. I was initially a journalist. I was the kind of like the resident tech-savvy young person in a newsroom who understood the internet. And I transitioned to working for a global development organization that helped civil society and women lead in independent media. And my boss came up to me one day and was like, this is where I want us to lead in technology. We need an overhaul website. I want to build these web apps. Can you do this? And at the time, I was a self-taught developer. All the code I knew how to write, I had taught myself how. And so I told her, I was like, yeah, of course I can do this. And I was like, kind of like panicked. I left work a day, like about an hour early that day, flew to a local community college, burst into some poor, counselor's office. And I was like, I need you to enroll me in some programming classes immediately. And she's like, do you even go here? And
I'm like, I do now.
Yeah, now I do. So over a year and a half, I mean, that changed my life. Like, that is the moment where I entered tech. I learned how to write clean code, the architecture behind building tech that can really connect communities, and it jump-started my new career.
That's interesting. You gave us a lot to work with and think with, and hope and think about. So I hope people are listening to that, and we'll go back and refer to that when they get discouraged. So, Norma, what about you?
I didn't grow up around tech. Actually, my mom has a second grade education, and I come from a Mexican American household. I was the happy victim of direct outreach by someone in my community who really cared about spreading the word and sharing their stories. And it's greatly influenced the work I do in the community now.
Can you identify a pivotal moment when you thought this is for me? Can you remember it? Can you tell us about it?
I absolutely remember it. It was a gentleman in our community who had graduated from my high school, gone off to MIT, and was coming back to talk to students. And as he shared his story and said, I grew up around the corner just like you did, and here's my family story. And if I've been able to go to MIT and succeed, you can too.
Wow.
That was a pivotal moment.
Wow, that's great. Ingrid, what about you?
Yeah, it's such a great story. I actually was very, very blessed growing up in a family with a father who was a mechanical engineer and a mother who was a psychologist. And so I always grew up around tech, and what actually got me into the tech field, though, was after I graduated from business school in Austin, Texas. It was during the dot-com boom, and, I was seeing all of these companies that were starting and getting funded and just doing so well. And I was really, really inspired that there was this guy who had started a multi-billion-dollar company out of the trunk of his car, that guy, of course, being Michael Dell. And I wanted to be like Michael. And so at the time, the internet was really not a very easy place to use. And having grown up around tech, having been inspired by my parents to really grow up in an environment where they felt like, with putting in the hard work, studying, going to school, that we could really learn to be, do, and have what we wanted to in life. And so that really gave me the foundation to believe at the time when I came out of business school that I, in fact, could be like Mike, and I wanted to build a billion-dollar company. And so I was inspired to figure out how to make the Internet an easier place to use and to work with. And so my first company was actually, I developed a system using neural network technologies. My first patent was actually using neural nets to develop personalization software. And that is what launched my first company and certainly my career in tech, and certainly has led to really the work we get to do these days, which is working with women around the globe in technology.
I started our conversations by thanking all of you for your willingness to participate in this conversation. All of you are very, very busy. But it was indicative of the kinds of conversations that we had both online and on Twitter, where people were very willing to share, you know, both their ups and their downs. And so, Sabrina, why don't I go back to you and ask, is there anything that, since we're on the air and maybe everybody isn't engaged with Twitter yet, and we hope people will, but if they haven't, is there something that you want to share now that you really want to share as a word of wisdom?
Oh, wow. Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, both participating in the series and kind of like watching this conversation happen online and off, one of the things that the words of wisdom I'd like to share is you get to build your own community. I mean, if you are not around people who are supporting and championing you in this field and in the work that you're doing, you can go and find them. And also that you don't need to pick up other people's stuff. There is this sort of perception of what a tech entrepreneur looks like in America. And let me tell you, that is a very limited, shallow perception. That's other people's stuff. You don't need to pick that up. You can look, sound different, be from every single different background. I'm a first generation American. I don't fit that mold. And if I chose to pick that up, it would be very, it would inherently limit where I could go and the rooms I could occupy. So that would be my word of wisdom, is to build your own community and don't pick up other people's stuff.
Nora Mae, what about you? I just want to mention you joined our Day in the Life Twitter campaign, where you tweeted a day in your life, and it got 9,000 tweets over the course of this month and millions of impressions around the world. And impressions, for people who are not aware, are the number of times the hashtag appeared in people's Twitter feeds. And you were telling us you noticed two distinct themes in the tweets in terms of how women viewed themselves at their tech jobs. Do you mind telling us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I really saw a dichotomy in the women that were tweeting really across the month. And there was the set of women who were really aware of the challenges women face in STEM or in the tech workplace. And then there was a set of women who chose to not look at their gender and not look at how that impacted their daily work. Now, for me in the aerospace business, the gender gap is really visible. I live it every day, and it's hard to ignore it. And I really make it a focus of my community work to get more women into the field. It was really interesting for me to see the other side of that, the side where the women don't have to worry about this, where they maybe, like Sabrina said, build a community that includes a lot of women, it includes a lot of people like them. But for people like me, I think the advice is for students graduating and entering a field in which there is a diversity or a gender gap, or maybe even an age gap, the advice is don't exhale just yet. There's a lot of work to do, and I don't think we often prepare the students for what they're going to face in the workplace.
Any more word of wisdom there for now? Do you want to add to that at all, Norma? So your word of wisdom is what? Is don't exhale just yet. And is it to dig into, or kind of a I'm intrigued by what you said, where a lot of people are saying ignore the ignore gender, ignore race, ignore ethnicity. You're saying you can't always. That's not always relevant.
Right.
Can you extend that thought a bit?
Yeah.
How would you want to address these issues?
Yeah. I think two concrete pieces would be for women in general. It's fine to put the gender aside, but realize that there are a lot of women in positions where they can't do that. The work environment is simply not conducive to avoiding the gender issue. And for college students graduating and entering the workplace, just know that you're not done. It feels great to graduate from a tough program. It feels great to be done with engineering school. There's still a lot of work left in getting women into executive leadership positions in the workplace.
Ingrid, what about you? You tweeted for the Day in the Life earlier this week, and thank you for that. Two questions to you. What struck you most about the conversations on Twitter, and do you have some concrete word of wisdom for us?
I do, and thank you so much for asking that, because I think a topic that certainly comes up a lot is, of course, you know, women in the field, which is my passion area, and diversity and how important that this is. And I think the thing that, you know, I always like to point out is I certainly understand why this comes up as an issue. I mean, I've raised money, you know, from all kinds of different investors throughout my entire professional career, and I often share the story that I'll never forget on my first time trying to raise money that I couldn't get it done at first. And one of my advisors pulled me aside and he said, look, you don't look like, act like, sound like, or talk like any of the CEOs that these investors are used to funding, and I don't know that you can get it done. And, you know, I really took that on as a challenge to say, you know, in fact, I'm a really strong CEO, and it doesn't matter what I look like, and it doesn't matter what my background is. In fact, it's an asset that I am different because I stick out. And how can we use that as an opportunity instead of a challenge? And so really turn that on its head. But one of the things that has been critical to my being successful in doing that, and my advice and recommendation is, number one, get a mentor. Absolutely get a mentor. That has been critical to my success throughout my entire career. And it directly addresses the issue that Forbes actually wrote an article recently, and they were saying the number one issue for women excelling in the workplace really comes down to confidence. You know, whether you're a man or you're a woman, we all have our challenges. We all have a lack of money, background, information, access, whatever it is. And so for women, though, it really is this confidence issue, because when you look around the room and you don't see a lot of role models that look like you, you know, you're oftentimes going out there and trying something for the first time, really. And so when you have a mentor, that really can help you move the needle forward. The second piece of advice that I would recommend is, next to having a mentor, is really surrounding yourself with a support group of people who absolutely understand where you're coming from and, again, can help you move the needle forward. This is one of the reasons why I was so inspired to work with Dell in the first place, because as far as large companies are concerned, this was the one large global organization that was rolling up its sleeves, reaching out to try to figure out how can we help women be successful. And they were doing it through, and continue to do it through, the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network. And so while it might sound biased now that I work with Dell and I love doing that, I highly recommend that there is a fantastic group of women involved in the Dell Women Entrepreneur Network. And that is a wonderful way to quickly tap into a group of women who have been in your shoes and can help you move things forward.
All right, duly noted. If you're just joining us, we're wrapping up our month-long series, Women in Tech. Our guests are Ingrid Vandervelt, that's who was speaking just now, of Dell, Norma Cadena of Boeing, and Sabrina Hersey-Issa of Be Bold Media. Sabrina, you wanted to add a thought to that, I understand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I kind of wonder what necessitates the need for mentors in tech. And I don't think it is totally a confidence issue. I think it's about access. I think it's about barriers to entry. And I think that actually leads to the necessity to have mentors and sponsors and community.
Do you have one? Do you have a mentor?
I have many. I have some who work in this building.
How do you get one? How do you get a mentor?
I think it's about being honest and open about your what you need in your career, about finding people. I personally am very proactive. I seek people out who I admire, who see something in me and help me be a better leader. But I think it is the best mentoring relationships are organic. It can't just be this, you know.
Will you be my mentor?
Of course. Will you be my
Norma, what about you? The question of mentorship and overcoming kind of barriers to entry. What's your thought about that?
I agree. I think mentors are crucially important, and the support network is important as well. And I also agree that you can't just reach out to a group and say, you're a successful woman or man, will you be my mentor? I think it comes down to values. And like Sabrina said, someone who sees something in you and is willing to help you grow and understands where you're coming from, understands your personal struggles. I think it is about a 50-50 issue between personal confidence and external factors that are barriers for women in STEM.
Ingrid, we have about a minute and a half left, so I'd love it if you would tell us about the Billionaire Girls Club. There's also a Billionaire Boys Club, too, isn't there?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what this group does and what you're trying to accomplish.
Oh, well, thank you. So actually, the Billionaire Girls Club, I mean, going back to the second point that I mentioned about putting together support networks, I actually teamed up with four other women CEOs now about 6 years ago. So before the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network ever existed, I had put this group together with these four other women, and essentially the five of us really lean on one another to support each other in our personal and professional success. And so what we have done and what we've done for the past 6 years is we essentially agree once a month on the first Wednesday of every month. We do an hour-long call and basically do a round robin. And it's a very safe place where we can openly share what our challenges are, and then we brainstorm as a group to help one another move the needle forward with whatever it is that we're facing. And then we come together twice a year in person to actually spend 2 to 3 days at a time together. So it has been a fantastic group to support one another in our success
Do you recommend this approach for others? Just very briefly, only have about 10 seconds. Do you think others could emulate this who aren't billionaire girls?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not a billionaire. I mean, I would love to be. Who would love to be? But it really follows the Muhammad Yunus model of pulling together, which is from microcredit, of course, okay, but of pulling together groups of five to support one another in each other's success.
All right, let's remember that. Groups of five. That's a good takeaway for now. Ingrid Vandervelt is entrepreneur in residence at Dell, among her other hats, and she directs the entrepreneur support program at Dell, and she's the co-founder of the Billionaire Girls Club. Norma Cadena is an aerospace engineer at Boeing and co-founder of Latinas in STEM. Sabina Hersey-Issa is CEO of Bold Media. Thank you all so much. Bold Media. Thank you all so much for joining us. And we had so much fun that we plan to continue our look at the gender gap in tech and ways of closing it through periodic Twitter chats. We're looking forward to engaging with NPR member stations as well. You can still join the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag NPRWIT, and you can email your ideas to tellmemore@npr.org. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.